Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back Craig Shapiro. Craig is a veteran investor, someone we've had on the program recently. Craig, an absolutely jam-packed week last week across the Treasury's quarterly refunding, the FOMC meeting, huge economic releases. You are short small cap stocks. Tell us why, break down the trade and the reasoning, please.
Yeah. So my view has been that the economy is performing better than expected on the labor front and on the growth front, and certainly on the inflation front. And so we've had sticky inflation for a while now, and inflation expectations have picked up in most recent months, kind of post the fourth quarter of last year when the Fed pivoted and Yellen pivoted by announcing less treasuries for sale. And so that has led to that loosening of financial conditions, which has allowed the economy to just kind of do better. But by doing so, we've made it more difficult for the Fed to actually achieve the last mile of bringing inflation back down to target. So when you reignite animal spirits and when you loosen financial conditions, you know, the public reacts, and the psyche of the investment public and the general public kind of goes out and spends, and there's wealth effect gains. And so the economy, you know, does better, and inflation doesn't return to target. And so the Fed has had to, you know, basically course correct from not giving that last rate hike in the fourth quarter of 2023 and coming into the year thinking they were going to be able to cut rates three times. We've seen the market rapidly move away from that dynamic and pricing out the rate cuts, and even to a point where the Fed is actively considering the idea that the next move may be a rate hike, and it may be necessary to really tighten financial conditions. They may have to go again and raise rates. And so in my view, as the economy, even though it's performing better than expected, there is profit headwinds that are developing and have been developing on the companies that can least deal with the sticky inflation. And those are the smallest companies. They have the most levered balance sheets. And so the actual rise in interest rates does crimp them in a much more adverse way than it does some of the big cap tech stocks and tech companies that have cash rich balance sheets and are actually earning additional income from having high interest rates. These small cap companies are often levered, and so higher borrowing costs are a hit to profit margins. Secondly, you know, labor costs are elevated, remain elevated. It's harder for small cap companies to hire and retain workers, and so their total employment costs are trending in the wrong direction. That crimps margins as well. And lastly, on energy and raw materials, it's just harder for small cap companies to pass along those commodity cost inflation pressures to their customers. And so there is a profit margin headwind that on small cap companies that I think will continue as we push through this year in light of this idea that the Fed is going to be having a very tough time bringing back, adding accommodation to the market. And so I don't think at this point, with inflation running well above target and trending in the wrong direction, that the Fed is going to be able to engineer any rate cuts at this point. And so higher for longer means more pressure on margins, more pressure on profits. The smallest companies are hit the worst. And so that's been kind of the genesis of the trade. The pushback to that idea has been a bit of, well, there's this great rotation going on. And so any money that flows out of big cap tech, specifically Apple, has to find somewhere to go. And so that makes it a little bit more difficult to kind of profit from that small cap deterioration at any, you know, particular point in time. But over the course of the next few weeks and months, you know, typically those short-term rotations play themselves out. And so I anticipate that we're going to see some pretty sizable underperformance for small caps in the, you know, coming weeks and months.
The Bitcoin Layer is very proud to be sponsored by River, a Bitcoin-only exchange and who we believe to be the leader in the business. Go check them out today at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 of Bitcoin for free when you go sign up. You have a lot of options when it comes to buying Bitcoin. We believe River is your best choice because they do not custody your Bitcoin on a third-party exchange. They have their own solution for storage, and they encourage you to get your coins off the exchange as soon as possible. River.com/TBL for that special offer.
And just to be thorough, are you long anything as a pair trade there? Like, are you long large cap stocks versus the small cap here, or is it an outright short?
Yeah, look, I mean, I have, you know, a portfolio of a variety of ideas. I mean, the construct that I'm working under is one of an economy that is going to be slowing, profits are slowing, and yet the Fed cannot provide accommodation to deal with that slowdown in the economy that I anticipate has already started and will continue. To the extent that the Fed, you know, did actually provide accommodation, weaken the dollar, bring down yields, I think there's other ways to be long. I think we mentioned last time, like, I've been long gold, I've been long Bitcoin, and I remain long those. So yeah, there's a bit of a pair there, and kind of long some of these store value assets that would benefit from an incremental pickup in liquidity, hedged with this idea of being short, you know, corporates and small cap corporates where profit and earnings momentum will deteriorate. So that is a bit of the genesis of the trade.
Sure. And of course, as a disclaimer here, we don't offer investment advice at the Bitcoin layer, and any trade that a guest might talk about has to be taken in context with the rest of their portfolio and can't be just thought of as a standalone trade idea necessarily. So that's why we have a discussion with Craig and we want to flesh it out. Of course, every portfolio has a lot of components to it, so any one trade has to be thought of in that context. So Craig, there's a lot of things I want to ask you. Let's start with Janet Yellen. What did you learn about Yellen and her approach to the political cycle? Because as everyone knows, we're half a year away from the election. You probably had a thesis on what she might do politically. How did that play out? Did it change? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So the Treasury comes out every quarter and announces its refunding needs and expectations for the following quarter. That announcement came last week on April 29th, and then again on May 1st. And on April 29th is when we got the total amount of borrowings that the Treasury would need. And then on the 1st, we got the composition of borrowings between bills, bonds, notes, et cetera. So my view had been that because the deficits in the U.S. continue to just run, you know, very large, well above normal, 6% or more of GDP kind of into perpetuity, that the Treasury's borrowing needs are endless, for lack of a better word. But there had been some expectation on two fronts that when Yellen came out with the announcement last Monday, it was going to come in better than expected. For one, there was a view that tax receipts had been coming in better than expected to start the year because of the capital gains taxes that were paid from gains made last year. So there was a thought that the overall borrowing needs may be less. And then secondly, there was a view that Yellen, because it's an election year, could act in a political way to provide more liquidity to the market by running down the Treasury General account, which is basically the Treasury's checking account. And so there was an expectation for some that because it's an election year, it'd be better for her to announce that there's going to be less borrowing needs for the Treasury, that provides some more liquidity and some more pump, for lack of a better word, into the markets as we kind of push through the election season over the course of the next 3 to 6 months. And so what we learned on Monday was that neither of those things were true. Tax receipts came in worse than expected. The Treasury's borrowing needs are higher than expected. And secondly, we learned that Yellen actually said she needs to have more cash on the Treasury's balance sheet than less. And the reason there's some formulaic reasons why Treasury needs to run with more cash. Basically, it's supposed to be, an expectation of what the government's borrowing and total spending needs are for any particular week, in case there is a reason why the government can't access the bond market, whether it's an act of war or terrorism or what, something like that. So there's supposed to be a buffer there. And Yellen came out and said, yeah, our cash buffer is higher. So that political dynamic that folks were believing was in there for Yellen really, I think, got pushed to the background. And then what we learned on Wednesday last week was that she's going to be issuing a lot of bonds. There had been an expectation that maybe she would cut the total amount of bonds and notes from one quarter, from the last quarter to this quarter, and the coupon sizes were unchanged. I mean, look, you could argue that is political because really what she should be doing is raising the coupon sizes. We've talked about term premiums are still very low. The yield curve is inverted. So there is incentive for the Treasury to be borrowing further out the curve. She decided not to do that, but it's not like she reduced the coupon sizes. She said, now we're keeping these flat. And there actually was some talk in the minutes of those committee reports that suggested that perhaps as early as 2025, we may start to see the long-term borrowing supply issuance grow again. So it seems like they've kind of tabled this for 2024, which I guess makes sense that there's some political component to that. We'll deal with this later. But the borrowing needs are high. It's net $500 billion per quarter of new duration issuance. And that number is likely to grow, you know, next year and beyond if we continue to run $1.5 to $2 trillion a year deficit. So I think we learned that Yellen is not as political as folks think, and that the put on the Treasury providing liquidity, the strike price of that put is lower than where markets are trading right now. It would come at a level of higher term premiums. It would come at a level of higher yields than where we are now. So I think that reality suggests that both term premiums and yields in the back end of the curve are going to be moving higher to deal with that incremental supply that's coming for the next 3 months.
And from my perspective, I'm always hesitant to forecast higher yields because of this flight to safety bid that could come at any minute if the data just sours tremendously. You might even see a bull flattening of the curve, the entire opposite move of a bear steepening, which is what Craig is describing. So I just want to say that quickly to the audience that the linear extrapolation of what's happening with Yellen, deficits, supply, all suggests higher term premium. The linear extrapolation of higher inflation is higher for longer absolute rates in the front end of the curve. So in that way, it's hard to imagine a bull move in the Treasury curve in any part of the curve right now. But my background and my bias tells me to not relinquish that approach to the market, to the Treasury market, that a bid can always come in. So I'm curious, Craig, your response there.
Yeah, look, as somebody who is a gold bull and a Bitcoin bull, clearly I believe that over time the U.S. is losing that flight to safety bid. I think the U.S. Treasury security is losing that flight to safety construct because of the way that the government prints money, the way that the deficits run unabated and accelerating for as far as the eye can see. There is no appetite in D.C. to raise taxes or to cut spending. And so we just borrow and borrow and borrow. And secondly, the U.S. government has decided to proactively come after its enemies' holdings of reserves, sanctioning Russia, sanctioning others that act in as an enemy to the U.S. And so, you know, for those reasons, foreigners' demand for U.S. treasuries over time will continue to go down. And so I think there is that concept of the bid to treasuries as a flight to safety in an economic slowdown scenario. I think it's there. It's hard to break down that psyche for domestic U.S. investors. But globally, I think we are already starting to see it break away. And so but I think, look, if you're concerned about a slowdown in the economy happening imminently, the yield curve is still inverted. I mean, you can still lock in pretty sizable yield by investing in T-bills, right? I mean, 5.2, 5.3, 5.4%. You roll them over every 4 weeks, every 8 weeks. It's unlikely that you're going to be surprised by an exogenous event that forces the Fed to cut rates aggressively here, that makes it so that you, first of all, you're not going to lose money on those T-bill investments, but that, you know, the reinvestment risk would be so disadvantageous to you because the Fed's not going to be cutting aggressively without, you know, some sort of major, strain or major slowdown in the economy, which, you know, look, right now, I don't think is very likely. The economy is slowing and is rolling over, but the speed of the economy doing so doesn't appear to be rapid. And so I don't think you're going to get surprised by an imminent aggressive Fed cutting cycle. So having your investments in short-term T-bills earning 5.2, 5.3%, I think makes a lot of sense, much more sense than owning, you know, a 4.5% 10-year bond.
Of course. So it sounds like maybe the sweet spot, if you expect the economy to slow down, would be somewhere in the 2 to 3 year part of the curve, is what I'm hearing from Craig. Because while he's saying bills, you know, what he's also suggesting is that if you think the economy is going to slow, it won't slow right away. So, you know, you'll be more advantaged owning in the front end of the curve in that scenario.
I'd also just say if you're concerned about a slowdown in the economy, you should be cautious with your equity holdings, right? Which kind of gets back to, you know, part of the reason why I'm underweight small caps here is I do believe that the economy is slowing, profits are slowing, earnings momentum will deteriorate. I just don't think that the Fed in a sticky inflationary environment is going to be able to provide liquidity and accommodation at a rapid pace. And so we said earlier is that the put from the Treasury Department is struck at lower prices. I also believe the put from the Fed is struck at lower prices. Yes, it's true. We just got some tapering of quantitative tightening, which on the margin adds some liquidity. But the Fed has talked about the interest rate tool as kind of really being their primary tool to bring inflation under control. And so I think in this regard, there's no rush for them to provide accommodation, even if the economy were to start to marginally roll over, you know, until the labor market really shows some signs of massive slowdown. I don't see the rationale for a rate cut.
I have a QT rant, but I will save the audience for a moment. If they want to hear my full thoughts on QT and the slowdown of QT, go check out my Friday video from last week, Global Macro Update. And maybe I'll get into it here shortly. But I wanted to go back to this idea of higher treasury yields. Now, I'm starting to more and more feel that the inflation battle is a battle in name only, and that persistently higher inflation, which is good from a debt to GDP ratio perspective, is the primary policy objective, and that everything else falls underneath that. The conclusion is, and the conspiracy here is, that the Fed doesn't really want to fight it that much because they're in concert with the government to try to get nominal GDP up to just inflate the debt away. This is financial repression 101. What are your thoughts, Craig? Is that fair, or am I reading too much into it?
I think it's fair. I think that Powell on consecutive press conferences has come out in a much more dovish way than what I think was warranted. And I think was really, doesn't necessarily reflect the entirety of the FOMC. I think there are various members of the board who are much more hawkish than him. And so the question is, why is he coming out? It's such a dovish construct. I mean, even at this
point. Okay, now, Craig, that's exactly the point here. Break it down for people. Basically, what Craig is saying is that inflation is high, so Powell shouldn't be dovish, but he is. And so there has to be a reason. So break that down for us.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of wrote a post about this last month, basically an Occam's razor, view of this, and the only explanation for his dovishness is what you mentioned, which is the primacy of a smooth functioning U.S. Treasury market, because the inflation data continues to run hotter than expected, and the labor market is beyond maximum employment. If you look back over 50 years, if you would have said where is maximum employment, everyone would have told you it's has a four handle, maybe even a five handle. We're running at sub 4%. And so the idea that, you know, a 2/10, 3/10 move in the unemployment rate from 3.5 to 3.7 to 3.8 is something that the Fed should be concerned about. It's ridiculous. And so we are at maximum employment. And we have inflation that continues to run above target and is likely to run above target for 5 years based on the Fed's own forecast. We're going to run from 2021 through 2026 at well above 2%. So is that an expeditious return to bringing inflation back down to 2%? I'd argue the answer is no. And so the only real explanation is that that there is some discussion between Powell and Yellen and the administration, and I suspect they meet pretty regularly, and which says that the U.S. government really cannot afford to have materially higher borrowing costs for forever. And so, you know, look, the issue that we have is that this concept of the Fed bringing down interest rates to help fund the government is something some people have said is fiscal dominance. I think it's really more like fiscal primacy, where the Fed is acting to just support the government. It's really not what the Fed should be doing. The Fed shouldn't be enabling the government's profligate spending and dysfunction by always bailing out the Treasury market at the first sign of strain. But it's hard to make any other argument as to why he comes out on press conferences and acts as dovish as he is. Even on this most recent one, when asked several times about were rate hikes an option, he really didn't even want to answer the question, which, and you see the reaction. What was the reaction to his dovishness? Was an immediate loosening of financial conditions, an immediate rise in equity prices, an immediate rally in bonds, a rally in gold, a rally in Bitcoin, a rally in all these inflation assets, which loosens financial conditions, reignites animal spirits, unanchors inflation expectations, and is likely going to lead to inflation moving back higher again. There was something that just came out from the New York Fed on housing, which said, you know, through in the February report, housing costs are reaccelerating now to the second highest levels that we've seen in the last, you know, in this last few years since COVID. I mean, people's expectations for home prices now are moving back higher because of the Fed's loosening of financial conditions. And so, look, I think that you can only argue that Powell is trying to keep overall borrowing costs muted because he understands his fiscal primacy argument. But I think there's others on the Fed who are going to continue to push in the direction of this is not what the Fed's job is. The Fed's job is to bring inflation back down to 2% and to ensure maximum employment. Those are the dual mandates. This primacy of smooth functioning U.S. Treasury markets is really not the mandate. And we need to have tighter financial conditions in order to bring down inflation. And that's what we need to do.
But they're not. That's the thing. And that's what's so curious. They're not making financial conditions tighter. They're making them easier. Before we started recording, we're recording here on Monday, May 6th, and this will air today. I was looking at the candles on the S&P, and this downtrend that we had for the last 3 weeks, just poof, gone, busted up above it. And stocks are off to the races again. And it's just amazing how they aren't marrying the spot inflation with the policy narrative at all. There's a disconnect. They're slowing QT, which is dovish. He refused, absolutely refused. He had so many opportunities to say, yes, there's finally some balance. We are aware that there is a risk to inflation getting out of hand. We don't want to just give the market an assumption that the next move will be a cut. He had so many chances to walk any of that back, and he didn't. And it's very curious to me.
Yeah. Look, I also think that they have put themselves into this box where they're trapped. And a lot of that has to do with, and I don't recall specifically what your QT rant was, but it actually has to do a lot with the idea that they have allowed QT to happen in such a passive way. The balance sheet went from $4 trillion to $9 trillion during COVID, let's say from April of 2020 through March of 2022. We went up by $5 trillion, and we've taken down liquidity over the course of the last 2 years by about $1.5 trillion, $1.6 trillion. That's not symmetrical. It's the Fed moves fast when it needs to stimulate, and it just moves too slow when it's removing accommodation. And it says, well, we want to keep a stable and secure banking system. And look, by keeping all that excess liquidity in the market, draining at a very passive way, and then coming in three times since they've said that they're going to, since QT, the Fed has interjected in the Treasury, basically in this three times, in October of 2022, in March of 2023, and then again in October of last year by putting more liquidity back into the market. And so why are they, you know, why are they doing this? And so I think by having this passive runoff of securities on their balance sheet, as opposed to a more active quantitative tightening where they're selling assets, they've kept liquidity too loose and they're making it impossible for them to bring inflation back down to 2%. So they've said the only tool we have is the rates tool. So at this point, if they raise rates more, it's not necessarily going to slow the economy in a way that they want, because the government is going to have to keep spending more and more money on interest expense, which goes to pay out to cash rich companies and households who borrowed in 2020 and 2021 at very low rates. So raising rates is stimulative. And if they cut rates and the dollar weakens and financial conditions loosen, commodity prices go through the roof, inflation expectations move up again, housing prices go back up again. And so inflation goes back up that way too. And so they've really put themselves in a box. And look, I don't really know exactly how they think they're gonna get out of it. Maybe they want to just keep, you know, punting until after the election. I don't exactly know. But look, from my perspective, what they need to do is they need to be more aggressive on the rates tool. They need to actually bring crimp private demand, force a slowdown, tighten financial conditions, dampen animal spirits, reduce and re-anchor inflation expectations in order to bring inflation back down to 2%. And if they're not going to do that, then we get back to your point, which is there's something else going on, and funding the government is their primary mandate, and we need to kind of, you know, trade and think accordingly.
And when I think about the Bitcoin price, it feels like it reflects this dynamic that there's no way out of increased liquidity. And I'll summarize my QT rant for you here, which is that the ample reserves framework seems to be the only thing that governs the Fed these days. They are so scared of dipping below what they feel is the ample reserve amount. They have September 2019, PTSD. And there's something in the financial system which makes them so scared of reserves becoming too thin. And what would be the knock-on effect of reserves becoming too thin? It would be that funding in the money markets would maybe have to go back to the Fed for a bailout, or that generally just money market spreads would widen, and that would restrict financial conditions. It would basically tighten economic activity at the margin. So isn't that what the Fed should want if it's trying to slow down inflation? But they are talking out of both sides of their mouth because they understand the risk involved in dipping below ample reserves, which is a pretend number in itself. It's a number they can't even quantify, but they know if they dip below that they blow up the world, and they're so scared of it that they have to lie to you. So that's my rant, Greg. I'm curious your thoughts
reserves. They are proud that they pat themselves on the back for QT having reduced the size of the Fed's balance sheet by 1.5, 1.6 trillion from the peak. But bank reserves are 3.3 trillion. They're basically flat. Looking at the chart right now, they're basically flat since we started QT. So bank reserves haven't moved at all. And prior to COVID, back in the 2019 repo crisis in September, bank reserves were 1.4 trillion. So under 1.5 trillion kind of got them scared. We're running 100%, 120% higher than that now. And they're afraid. And so I don't really understand why that is such a concern for them. I mean, the way that what should have went down is they should have orchestrated what I've described as more like LIFO monetary policy, which is when you want to stimulate the economy, first you bring rates to zero. And if that doesn't work, or you need more, then you engage in quantitative easing and you expand the size of the Fed's balance sheet. You provide liquidity through the portfolio balance, channel. When you want to exit that, what should you do first? First, you should do quantitative tightening to reduce the liquidity that came from quantitative easing. And if that doesn't work, then you could start raising rates. So that's what they should have done. They should have brought down the size of the balance sheet to a proper level. From, you know, bank reserves were, you know, peaked out at, you know, $4.3 trillion. They could have rapidly taken them back down. They were at 1.5 before COVID. They got to $4.3 trillion. They could have taken those down much more aggressively, kind of dealt with some of that pain that may have happened, and not raised rates in 2022 and 2023 as a response to inflation. Because if they would have done it that way, animal spirits wouldn't have been as crazy. Inflation expectations would have been more anchored. Yes, it's true. Russia attacked Ukraine. Commodity prices would have, you know, moved higher. But that's not something that the Fed needs to respond to with raising interest rates. All raising interest rates have done this time is make it more expensive for the government to borrow, has provided hundreds of billions in interest rate stimulus paid out to the wealthy homeowners and corporations who have locked in low-cost borrowings. And so raising rates this time has been more inflationary because of the size of the deficits and because of the size of the debt on the government's balance sheet. And, you know, by doing it in reverse, and the rationale at the time was, well, the public doesn't really understand the balance sheet. The public really understands interest rates as a tool. And so interest rates moving up will restrict demand. It was an incredibly naive assumption. Was it gaslighting? Probably, because I think the public is well equipped, and there's plenty in the public who can help articulate why balance sheet reduction is the same or better than raising rates. So the Fed was gaslighting people, and now they're in this box, and they've trapped themselves because they're tapering, as you mentioned, quantitative tightening. They're slowing down the pace of balance sheet reduction at the same point in time where they're trying to bring down inflation. It's like they're doubling down on this flawed policy, you know. And I think what we're going to be in is a situation where the Fed's not going to be able to cut rates, doesn't want to raise rates, inflation expectations will remain high. At some point, the long end of the bond market is going to call BS on all this, and we'll see. And that may be the factor that finally gets us. And is it going to happen in this week's auctions? Probably not. But there will be a set of auctions at some time in the future where the long end really sells off because of this recognition that the Fed and Treasury together are not trying to bring inflation back down to 2%. And the dollar is going to be the release valve, kind of trade accordingly. And I think that's what gold and Bitcoin kind of being sticky at their highs, despite real rates moving higher and despite interest rates being as high as they are, I think that's what is suggesting.
Now, I want to push back a little bit on the economy. Right now, we had pretty bad economic data last week. So, and you are short small cap, so you're not expecting a runaway economy either. So I'm wondering, explain to people, Craig, why or at what point you feel that the interest rate hikes stop becoming stimulative, as you mentioned, the interest income channel, and all that money hitting people's pockets, but there's still borrowers. We see delinquency rates rising. We see the employment condition worsening. So it really explained to people that might not understand that high policy rates are still going to affect the economy in a negative way at a certain point. Is it happening now? What do you see, and how do you process both of those things? I think that really confuses people where they hear that rate hikes have been stimulative, but wait, now they're not stimulative anymore. I think it confuses people.
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think the idea that monetary policy works with long and variable lags is still accurate. I think it's the case, though, that financial conditions move much more rapidly and do have real impacts on the economy in real time. Mortgage rates go up and go down rapidly over the course of short-term periods of time. It does affect the psyche of borrowers in the housing market. But structurally, over time, this idea that higher rates kind of stay ingrained will slow down growth as small cap companies have to refinance their debts. So they have 3 to 5 year debts, let's say. You know, as we start to move into the end of 2024 and into 2025, the borrowing cost for those companies is moving higher. So we are now, I think, moving into the point where the negative effects of higher rates are starting to hit the economy. We're finally getting that, right? I think this past week, the services ISM number, it was pretty bad. And look, that's a survey. It's not the greatest survey. It typically correlates to the stock market, which was poor in April. But as the service economy starts to slow and readings under 50 on the services economy and new orders were weak and employment indicator was weak, and even the payroll data kind of came in a little bit weaker than expected, you know, I think we're there, right? I think this is the point where maybe that balance between higher rates are stimulative versus higher rates are contracting growth. I think we're in that point. In this second quarter here in 2024, I think we're at that threshold. So I would anticipate that the impact of higher rates is now starting to hit the economy in a much more accelerating pace. However, because of the sticky inflation, the Fed is prevented from acting accordingly and providing stimulus. It's just too soon for the Fed. The Fed's reaction function with 3-month annualized core PCE is close to 4%. So it's just too high. I mean, prior to COVID, the Fed's reaction function to a decline in growth that we're seeing now would have been to add accommodation. But when you're running core inflation at, 3.5-4%, the Fed's hands are way more tied. And so I think that's the air pocket that we're about to come into. Economy slows, Fed can't really address it. And that is a toxic setup for investing in, the most levered companies in the U.S., financial levered, operation levered, and that's basically small caps.
And the dynamic of financial conditions shifting very quickly in response to Fed rhetoric and then trickling into the real economy and spot inflation was something you talked about on our last show, I've written about, and Powell refuted. I don't know if you caught that in the press conference. He was given the opportunity to say that maybe my pivot in December bumped up inflation in the last few months. And he said, no, there's no way that happened. I deny that is the dynamic out there.
These are smart guys. And so I'm reluctant to say that they're naive and they don't understand how the market reacts to what they say and what they do. It doesn't make sense to me that they're so naive. So it means that they know and they're okay with it. I think, as I think I mentioned on the last time, I think the Fed is in that volatility dampening business, and volatility levels get too high. They come in and they sell volatility to try to make sure that we don't have a adverse shock in rate markets or in equity markets. And on the flip side, I think what I've said also is when volatility is too low and animal spirits are elevated and inflation expectations are moving higher, they have at times come in and introduce volatility to prevent that. I had thought that Powell had the opportunity here at the March meeting and then again at this meeting to introduce that volatility, because there are more members on the Fed who are suggesting that the Fed needs to do that. I mean, Michelle Bowman was out again yesterday. She's the most hawkish member on the Fed. And she's specifically talking about how financial conditions loosening are making it more difficult for them to achieve their target. And so I thought there was a setup there for Powell to deliver that. He once again has refused to talk about how he impacts financial conditions. And so either he's naive or he's gaslighting. I think he's gaslighting.
Craig Shapiro, thanks for your insights. Please tell people where they can find you.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. I've been pretty active. My handle is CES921. I also provide consulting services for Leduc Trading. And I just launched my own website called The Aletha Narrative, which is a repository for my thoughts and my views as I search for the truth amongst market narratives. So thanks again for having me, Nick.
Of course, we'll catch you guys next time. The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by River. River.com/TBL for that special offer. And the reason that we love River at the Bitcoin Layer is that they put your education first. River.com/learn to understand what Bitcoin is, the fundamentals. Also, how to get your Bitcoin off the exchange into your own custody solution. You can use river.com/learn for all of that information. Go check them out today.